Welcome to the new edition of Marijuana Compassion and Common Sense, the show that tells you the truth about marijuana, reveals the politics behind its prohibition, gives you the facts and information about its legendary health and medical benefits, and tries to clear up all that legal mumbo-jumbo that makes it so difficult, so dangerous, and nearly impossible for you to avail yourself of this ancient medicinal herb. Well, welcome. We're glad to have you join us on this new edition of Marijuana Compassion and Common Sense. As always, as I always say, hey, we have a fabulous show for you tonight, but or daytime, whenever you happen to be listening to it. But not only fabulous, this is an incredible show. And with an incredible guest, so I think you're going to find it really, really interesting. You know, Proposition 64, and that's what the show is going to be about, was supposed to end the criminal penalties for cannabis consumption and allow for the creation of a licensed and regulated businesses to produce, manufacture, and distribute cannabis to both medical and recreational users. Unfortunately, Proposition 64 was not written to create a cannabis nirvana, but rather to assuage the fear of voters who are on the fence about legalizing it. Attorney J. David Nick believes Prop 64 has totally failed to meet its goal of cannabis justice and produce a sensible, rational, and reasonable system of regulation. With precision analysis, he will be pointing out that this current system of loopholes for prosecutors, outrageous taxation, over-control by local municipalities, and the crazy quilt map of municipalities that continue to have total bans without justification or a vote by their local citizens has created a system that is so bad that the only solution would be to submit a new proposition to voters to correct all these problems. So we're going to be having J. David Nick on in just a few minutes. But first, I just want to talk a little about 2020. 2020. You know, 2020 has been quite a year for cannabis reform. Cannabis was the big winner in the 2020 elections, with four states legalizing cannabis for adults for any reason, and the first state in the South, Mississippi, to legalize it for medical use. And in California, 33 municipalities also voted to allow cannabis businesses to operate for the first time, as provided by Proposition 64. In what was a little notice that's going on other areas about how wonderful 2020 was, this all seemed to happen in the last few months, in what was a little notice decision, on Wednesday, December 2nd, the United Nations Commission for Narcotic Drugs, cannabis was removed from Schedule 4 of the 1961 Single Convention on Narcotic Drugs. It was taken out of the category with all these dangerous drugs like heroin and so on, put down lower as a less dangerous drug. This decision is expected, really, to have far-reaching impact on marijuana research and medical use throughout the world. The icing on the cannabis reform cake for 2020 came on Friday, December 4th, when the House of Representatives passed the MORE Act, which removes cannabis from the Schedule of Controlled Substance and would thereby end federal cannabis prohibition. Now, the final vote, the final victory, was stalled at the last minute by a pitch pushed by Republicans to add workplace drug testing language to the bill. That fortunately failed. The bill didn't fail. It eventually passed 228 to 164. 40 representatives abstained from voting. 6 Democrats voted against it, and 6 Republicans voted in favor. 6. 6 Republicans out of 197 Republicans in the House of Representatives. That's 3% of the Republicans. 95% of the Democrats voted for the MORE Act. Cannabis law reform is hardly a bipartisan issue, no matter who says it. You know, Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, said, quote, today with the bipartisan MORE Act, the House proudly passed one of the most important criminal justice reform bills in recent. Bipartisan. You know, I have said that. I have said this is a bipartisan issue. It's not a bipartisan issue. When just 3% of the Republicans in the House of Representatives support it and 95% of the Democrats support it, that's not bipartisan. So, you know, if you want to see cannabis legalized and people stop putting in jail and all this kind of stuff, you're going to have to support the Democrats because the Republicans are not going to do anything about it. And, you know, here's the thing. It passed the House. Now it goes to the Senate. But it's going to need the concurrence of the U.S. Senate for it to become law. And it's not going to happen as long as Mitch McConnell remains the majority leader. The only thing more unlikely than Democrats taking both Senate seats in this upcoming Georgia election and regaining control of the Senate is for the Republicans to replace McConnell as Senate Majority Leader. You know, I sent some money to Georgia to help those two people running in the U.S. Senate seat. At least I'm going to do it. I really encourage you to do the same. It's a long shot, but you know, you don't give up just because it's a long shot. You keep working on it. So, but still, the significance of the MORE Act vote really should not be underestimated, as I believe it will give many state legislators who support allowing cannabis to be legalized in their states to go ahead and draft legislation and introduce it, because the House of Representatives has said, yeah, let's do that. Okay, we've made great progress this year, but we, of course, still have a long way to go. Your support of organizations that are helping to reform cannabis laws, such as MAP, Marijuana Prohibition Project, the little organization we have here in the Inland Empire, will work. You need to keep supporting them. You don't, you know, just because it's been legalized here in California and some other states doesn't mean you should stop supporting. You need to support them if we're ever to make this ancient herb safely, legally, reliably, locally, and most importantly, affordably available and accessible. Okay, so much for that. Let's get to our show, because you know a lot of this has to do with Prop 64. When Prop 64 passed in 2016, a lot of us thought Nirvana was here. There's a lot of naysayers when Prop 64 was on the ballot, but fortunately there was more yes-sayers because it passed by 57%, which if any elected official had gotten that much of a percentage of the vote would be jumping up and down that they got a mandate from the voters. Well, Proposition 64 may have had a mandate, but it's had a lot of problems being implemented. Attorney J. David Nick, who is our guest tonight, believes Proposition 64 has totally failed to meet its goals of cannabis justice and a sensible, rational, and reasonable system of regulation put in place. With a precision analysis, he points out that this current system, polls, for prosecutors. You know what? I've already said that in the beginning of the show, didn't I? Why am I repeating myself? I'm not even stoned yet. Maybe that's the problem. Hey, listen, with offices, I want to tell you a little bit about J. David. He has offices in San Francisco and Palm Springs. He's been practicing law for 28 years. His areas of legal expertise include federal and state court litigation, criminal defense, appeals in criminal and civil matters, and civil litigation. He has had multiple appellate court opinions on the subject of cannabis regulation published. From criminal liability to regulation, taxation, and cannabis business disputes, he has represented many cannabis icons, such as Dennis Perrone, Brownie Mary, Steve Covey, and that organization of all organizations for us, NORML, the National Organization of Reform of Marijuana Laws. David, welcome to Marijuana Compassion and Common Sense.
Well, thank you for having me and for the introduction, Lanny. It's nice to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here because, a lot of us, you know, we were big supporters of 64, and we're certainly glad to see that, you know, it's legal and the arrest rates have gone way down and people are getting out of prison and they're having their records expunged. That's been pretty good. But, you know, some other things at 64 have not worked out anywhere as hope as good as we have. And you're going to talk about that. So why don't you take over?
Well, you know, let's just say this. I was a big supporter of Prop 64, along with many other people. Certainly it was a step forward, but there is no doubt that many of the problems that were experienced during, I'll just call it the cannabis prohibition period, continue to fester, and that what the voters of California wanted to get out of this law is just not being delivered. And it's time that we consider a new sweeping proposition that finally closes the door on some of the leftover injustices and some of the other regulatory problems that keep dragging the cannabis business world down. They can be broken up into three areas. One is the continuing felony prosecution of cannabis offenses. I think many of us thought that was going to disappear. As you previously mentioned, it certainly has gone down dramatically. But I will mention some of the details of what continues to happen in that area. The second area is, it was an issue before Prop 64 was passed, and that was the infamous Inland Valley Patients Health and Wellness Center case, where the Cal Supreme Court basically ruled that under traditional land use control laws that the cities and local municipalities could continue to regulate these activities to the point of banning them altogether. And so it seemed like that was one of the issues that Yuma was addressing, but in the end, it's really provided a overwhelmingly unbalanced power given to local authorities to regulate cannabis businesses to the point of, again, imposing a total ban without permission from their local voters. And as I will discuss in the show, and we'll get into it, this is in essence created sort of like an artificial economic market in the cannabis industry that is just really a complete disaster, burdening the cannabis industry with incredulous taxation and regulations that no other industry, even the ones that it was supposed to model, which is alcohol, is not saddled with. And the third really just is a subcategory of the second one, and that's the complete overtaxation of cannabis that is allowed by Yuma.
Yeah.
These three areas, Lanny, they represent such a gargantuan drag on the ultimate goals that the citizens in the state had when they passed Yuma that, the rational conclusion is that unless these problems are addressed in a new proposition, which is the only way to really do it, I suppose the legislature could address it as well because Yuma permits that. It's not going to look pretty if this continues for another 5 years. It's going to allow.
Go ahead. Let's talk about. Let's get down. And you know, you broke it into three sections. Let's talk about each section. In particular, let's first talk about, since I mentioned it, the arrest rates have gone down, people are getting out of jail, but you said there's still problems going on with the prosecution of cannabis crimes. Could you, expand that? Tell us what is going on still.
As I explained this legal problem that exists, it's not, but I just use it as an analogy. It's kind of like the death penalty, where prosecutors have the discretion of seeking it or not. It's totally up to them. And the way that Yuma was drafted, it left some very large loopholes, some of which have been already approved by the appellate courts, that allow prosecutors in almost every single circumstance, almost, not all of them, to charge felony conspiracy crimes. In California, if two or more people agree to commit a misdemeanor, that all of a sudden becomes a felony by virtue of the conspiracy laws. Yuma did not clearly address that. They mention it. I believe I know what the intent of the drafters were, but the Court of Appeals hasn't bought that, and they basically have allowed prosecutors, in any case where two individuals are growing more than six plants, which is what it allows, if for whatever rationale that prosecutor chooses, that individual now is facing felony conspiracy allegations.
So what you're saying is if two people living in different residences are each growing 10 plants, and they don't have a medical recommendation which would allow them to grow that, and they talk to each other about how they grow, they can be charged with a felony conspiracy?
That's correct. And, it continues to happen. Oh, yes. I've had to defend those cases myself. I'm defending one right now.
Tell us about one case.
Certainly. I have one case where two individuals are pulled over with a little bit over 3 pounds, no license, claim that it's for personal use, and the charges end up being felony conspiracy charges to transport.
Right. Let me understand something here. Because if you had more than an ounce and you're out of your house, that's a misdemeanor, isn't it? It's not a felony.
Exactly. And even if there was only one person in that car, it would still be a misdemeanor.
Right. And so what you're saying is, so these people had committed a misdemeanor by having more than an ounce on them, but because they were together, they got charged with a felony?
Exactly. More than together.
Oh, my gosh.
There's conspiracy, all it needs is just anything that shows you're helping one another out to commit that offense. And so
that's outrageous. It's
completely outrageous. It's the most outrageous loophole of them all. The other one, which is another gargantuan loophole, is that Yuma failed to address two health and safety code sections that made it unlawful to maintain a place for the purposes of storing, giving away, or using cannabis. And again, they look at a case, they're like, we don't like this person. Now all of a sudden the person is not only charged with misdemeanor cultivation, but now they're charged with felony maintaining a place, which all you need to do is commit the offense inside of a structure, and that offense currently applies. The court the appellate courts are still trying to sift through that issue, but as it stands right now, it's commonly charged anytime a marijuana arrest occurs inside a home, inside of a structure of any kind. And this is another one of the injustices. These were all crimes that were supposed to be misdemeanors that were supposed to be dealt with.
Let's talk about this one a little more because I think people need to understand this one, and I'm not sure I understood. So if you're storing marijuana in your home, that can be considered a felony? I mean, like you've got
correct.
I understand the law says, Proposition 64 says, you can have as much marijuana in your home as you produce. You just can't leave with more than an ounce.
Exactly.
And what you're saying is, so if you have a pound and a half of marijuana that you grew, you could be charged with a felony because you're storing it there?
You could be charged. So, yes, and normally it's a situation where you got more marijuana than you're supposed to, you're cultivating more than you're supposed to, and you're doing it in a structure. And this is my opinion is that...
Does that mean if you're growing outside, you're not going to get charged, but only if you're growing indoors?
Once you start bringing the marijuana inside and storing it inside, yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Sorrow.
And, these things, Lanny, they don't happen every time, but you can see it's a weapon that they use for whatever case.
If it happens once, it's too much.
It's too much. All these were supposed to be acts that were to be treated by a simple misdemeanor, and the law was very clear, the circumstances where a felony would apply. They're super rare. There are people with, like, prior violent strikes, prior serious sexual conduct crimes that they're required to register as a sexual offender. And so these are some of the dangers that, you know, the common person out there that may think they're behaving lawfully or only violating the law and exposing themselves to a misdemeanor are really not. It's a huge problem. The conspiracy issue is more problematic, Lanny, because that's supported by case law now. Now there's an appellate court decision that says, prosecutors, you can do that. Yuma allowed you to do that. And so this creates a huge problem with respect to the goals that this proposition was addressing. And on this same front, the prosecution of crimes is a problem. One of the more problematic aspects of Yuma is that it also left prosecutors a loophole with respect to asset forfeiture. The proposition fails to make it clear that asset forfeiture was abolished. And I can report to you and your listeners that this continues to be a tool used by law enforcement and district attorney's offices, and they continue to seize cannabis assets and subject them to forfeiture for anybody who doesn't have a license, basically. And so you got 6 marijuana plants and $20,000 in cash you've been saving forever. That's going to get seized, and then you're going to have to go to war with the government.
I thought you can have 6 marijuana plants.
You can, exactly, but there's nothing – exactly. The presence of the marijuana and the money will allow them to commence a civil forfeiture action against the money. And, again, these are things that were not supposed to happen. Unfortunately, these are some of the drawbacks of propositions. When they have to be crafted in a way to sell them to the voters, many things are left unclear on purpose in order to let the citizenry settle it in the courts. I remember you saying back in 2016 that Yuma had so many aspects that were unclear that it was a full-time, you know, lawyer type of act, basically meaning that a lot of attorneys were going to be addressing a lot of the problems. And, last thing to say on this is because the numbers of arrests and the number of times they do this has, in fact, been reduced, we don't hear about these injustices as much as we used to. But I can tell your listeners, they are occurring. They are for real.
And they don't want to happen to them. Yeah, it's true.
Yes.
That's true. I did say that a lot of this thing is going to be a full employment program for attorneys. But I also pointed out that unlike most initiatives, which are sacrosanct and can't be changed, AMA had built into it that the legislature could change it with a simple majority, and that these bad parts of AMA, it was up to the cannabis activists and consumers and stuff to pressure their legislatures to make these changes. But that hasn't happened.
Yeah, undeniably, they you know, in which that, I think, brings us to the next issue. You know, the taxation issue may be what's keeping them. They're afraid to lose that tax base if any tinkering is done. But they definitely, I invite your viewers to make their representatives aware of these issues. They're very simple. It's the use of conspiracy laws against people that would otherwise be committing misdemeanors, the use of leftover maintaining a place for purposes of storage laws that were not abolished by Yuma that continue to be abused, and asset forfeiture in cannabis matters. Continue to be abused whenever prosecutors find it that it's in their interest to do so. Yuma also continues the second big problem, Lanny, is to perpetuate a form of prohibition wherever a local municipality feels like doing so. It permits local municipalities to tax cannabis businesses and to do so in addition to the tax imposed by the state. I don't know of any other industry that's burdened by this type of double taxation. I certainly welcome anybody to educate me on that, but I cannot think of any other industry that has six layers of taxation imposed upon them. Six or four. You get excise tax, sales tax, state, and then excise tax, sales tax.
You have local excise tax. I mean, for alcohol.
Right, exactly. On the local level.
And tobacco,
the local
there's
level.
State excise taxes, but local governments can't impose excise taxes on cigarettes, can they?
Exactly. They cannot. And, it's – I can assure you that I welcome any economist to look into this. It is a form of taxation that really it's hard for me to express what it would do to a normal industry to be taxed in that manner. And I think some of the problems that's creating, we're seeing them emerge. This leads local governments to provide licenses to preferred business partners. They can artificially limit the number of cannabis business without any rationale. And they can use the state's tax base to create task forces to enforce the unlicensed cultivation, which in the end has the effect of ensnaring personal growers. And this year, by the way, we saw the first time that that had really come to fruition. There were statewide raids this year, all happening right at harvest time. They happened across the state. CAMP was revamped. They have been committing cannabis injustices longer than that task force, longer than anybody I can remember. I mean, I can remember them operating in the 80s and people complaining about it back then in my college years. And this year they descended on every cannabis growing county that you could think of in California. They seized some grows, made arrests in others. Typical thing that you would see back in the Prohibition.
Well, now were these large scale grows that people were growing that hadn't received state or local licenses?
You would find, yes, within the people that were raided, there were large scale, but then there's also small scale. And the search warrants this year were so unique. It was nothing that I had ever seen. They would put a lot more effort into it back in the days before Prop 64. The search warrants now are just flying over a property, identifying the APN number, and saying that there's no permit connected to that property. And that's it. They get their warrant. They go in. They seize the grow. That was all funded by these crushing taxes that cannabis cultivators and retail outfits and distributors that they're all subjected to. The local bans also, I want to again remind the audience that this was one of the biggest problems that Yuma was supposed to address, is to create a balanced system where the local government would not have such overwhelming control. But it never did that. And its attempt to do so, which was an attempt to basically say in the proposition, the original purpose of the drafters was to allow total bans only if a local municipality submitted it to its voters for approval. That was dropped at the final second. It was left in the purpose portion of the entire proposition, which isn't strong enough to get the courts to do anything. And the danger of this type of total ban system is that it's created an artificial market. And what do I mean by that? all the business is concentrated in limited areas. It's great that this year we saw an expansion of municipalities allowing this. I hope that it continues to do so, because that could alleviate some of the problems, which is that the state doesn't get enough tax money. Why? Because they don't have enough licenses given out. Why? Because there continues to be a stranglehold from municipalities across the state not permitting any cannabis activities, commercial cannabis activities at all of any kind. This type of, I just call it a kind of a diffused authority system where, and I'm sorry, one last area I wanted to cover before I go into the diffused authority theory is that local municipalities are then allowed to almost set up their own regulatory aspects, even if it's a total ban. And the ones that don't have a total ban and get the taxation money are then using that to that funding to fund task forces peculiar to their area, to their county, which are then used to go after unlicensed grows. And half of the people they get are trying to sell on the black market, a problem that's perpetuated and created by the difficulty in getting licenses. Believe me, if anybody could, every one of those growers would be happy to take to pay for a license, but they just can't get it because of the bottleneck that we have.
Right. As I have said, when I've gone before a number of city councils and county boards who were drafting some ordinances, and I've usually always started out my presentation by saying, I'm glad to see that you are looking into allowing cannabis business to operate, but looking at the draft plans of what you put here, it would be easier for me to open up a nuclear power plant than to grow a cannabis plant or sell it.
It's amazing.
They're so convoluted. They're unbelievable.
Unbelievable. I mean, just to deal with a weed that grows out of the ground, basically, is,
yeah.
And that its value as a trading narcotic just continues to go down, down, and down. It's now sort of like a gray market product, really, even across the United States. And so, you know, the local municipalities are imposing fines that would just make your eyeballs bog out. I have a client in one area of California that their fine was $150,000. Now, that will all be negotiated and probably reduced, but these are the kind of nutty things that are going on out there with this absolute local authority that is diffused throughout the state. You know, they don't have that for alcohol. The most that local governments get to do with respect to alcohol is they get to zone it. You can have it over here. You can have it over here. But it's the state that determines how many licenses are given for a particular municipality, not the local government. And go ahead.
I was going to say, before we go, because I want you to talk more about this diffuse thing and about the taxes and this kind of stuff. But we're a halfway point here, so I need to take a break for a couple of minutes. So if you can just hang tight, and let me take this, and we'll get right back to you, okay?
Certainly. Thank you.
Okay. Well, you know, I've got you may be wondering, you know, the holidays are coming, and you're looking for a very special gift to give to one of your cannabis connoisseur friends. Now, I have a suggestion for something a little different, and that is a gorgeous print called Higher Power 420. It's a mind-boggling limited edition print depicting everyone's favorite deities in a joyous 420 celebration. Conceived and designed by moi, and artistically executed by Shane Master Creation Hibbets, Higher Power 420 is an engaging, thought-provoking, and satiric look at the foibles of religion and the role of marijuana can play in today's polarized and estranged world. That's the core of Higher Power 420, a beautiful art fence depicting the gathering together of the iconic religious figures of today enjoying each other's company. Higher Power 420 depicts these favorite deities in a joyous 420 celebration as they escape from their inherent incessant squabbles as they relax and enjoy each other's company while sharing their common, albeit supernatural, humanity. Only cannabis could allow them to kick back with each other as well as help them overlook and forget about their inherent competing claims to theistic dominance. In Higher Power 420, they share it all. Higher Power 420 is a limited edition iconograph. Each 16 by 20 art print is signed and numbered by the artist and comes with a certificate of authenticity. Be the first to have one. Adorn the wall of your home or office. Sure to be a conversation starter in any situation. And like I said, it makes the perfect gift for your sophisticated cannabis connoisseur friends. Cost is only $24.20, and that includes all shipping and handling charges. To see this and order it, go to ebay.com and in the search bar, type Higher Power 420 Art Print. Higher Power 420 Art Print. And it will come up. You can see this gorgeous print. And if you're so inclined, you can then order a copy for yourself, for your friends, for whoever. Once again, Higher Power 420, it's an art print you'll always remember. Okay, the other thing I wanted to talk to you about quickly was about the Marijuana and Prohibition Project. MAP is a local Inland Empire-based cannabis law reform organization. We'd like you to find out more about it. Go to our website at marijuananews.org. I put out a newsletter that comes out once or twice a month, and if you would like to receive my newsletter and my rather unusual take sometimes on different subjects regarding cannabis and sometimes other things as well, at the website where it says marijuananews.org, go to the masthead, it'll say newsletter, click on that, fill out the box, and you will start receiving my newsletter in your email basket. And I promise you, you only get one or two a month. Your email basket will not become overflowed. I'm sure it's already overflowing, even more overflowed with material for me saying, hey, read this, read that, read this. No, be very specific. I promise you, only one time, two times a month. And if you don't like it, you can always scroll to the bottom of any newsletter that you receive, and there's an unsubscribe button, and you can unsubscribe for it. But I'll bet you, if you start subscribing to it, you won't unsubscribe. Okay, well, we're going to get back to J. David Nick, and we're going to be talking more about the failures of Proposition 64 and what to do about it. David, you know, I want to point something out because this is about taxes. I would really love to have your comment on this. Everybody, the taxes are absurd. They're absolutely absurd. They're 30% of the cost of the product.
It's so outrageous. But anyway, go ahead, Lanny.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing that I always want to put out. Part of the problem, or most of the problem that I see it, is that the outrageous cost of production. That it's so ridiculously absurd to produce it that it's very, very expensive. No other agricultural crop. I mean, marijuana right now has the price per pound on the wholesale market has come down quite a bit from what it used to be $2,000-$3,000 a pound. Now it's down to around $1,000 a pound. But that's still absurd. What agricultural crop in its raw, basically unprocessed form is worth $1,000 a pound? Nothing.
Yeah, not even marijuana your best, Cabernet grapes. So.
Right. I mean, and I remember when I was in Solvang area, went around to the local farms there, and the farmers had their produce out for sale. We drove down to one farm, and along with his Brussels sprouts and his corn and stuff, there was these beautiful beefsteak tomatoes, just gorgeous. And he was selling them for $1.50 a pound. And I said, "You grow them?" He said, "Yeah." And he pointed down to a couple greenhouses he had on his farm property. So can I go down and take a look? He said, "Sure." So I went down. These greenhouses were huge. I swear they're half the size of a football field. And inside it was just rows after rows after rows of these tomato plants growing in plastic bags, not even buckets, and up a trellis. And they were selling, and he was selling them for $1.50 a pound and making a profit. And you go to a store. and you pay $3 a pound. And that includes the farmer's market and the farmer's profit and the distributor's profit and the store's profit, $3 a pound. Cannabis is no more difficult to grow than tomatoes. But just for the sake of argument, let's say it's 10 times more difficult and expensive to grow than tomatoes. So instead of $3 a pound, you're going to be paying $30 a pound. And if you put a tax on it of 100%, you're then paying $60 a pound, which works out to what, about $5 an ounce? Who's going to sit there and complain $5 an ounce? The taxes are not so much I see the problem as I see the cost of production. And these laws make it so difficult to produce. First of all, you can't even grow like hundreds and hundreds of acres of like any other crop. You're limited in what you can grow. That they're just making it impossible for this product, agricultural product, to ever have the same cost as any other agricultural product.
Yeah, and you know, with that, Lanny, I totally agree. We could even call that the fourth category, which is the overregulation of this industry. I think that your analogy of making it seem like you're operating a nuclear power plant is apt. And I think all of America agrees that overregulation can kill businesses. That's a political mantra in certain circles. And I just cannot think of any other industry that has got, it's like an encyclopedia of regulations just to grow a plant. Completely dragging down the industry. And then when you have the problem of overregulation by the state, which was done, I mean, think about it, Lanny. It's the biggest bureaucracy ever created in the state of California. I think it encompassed at first four departments, if I can remember correctly, which is it created the Bureau of Cannabis Control. It brought in the Department of Agriculture. It brought in the Department of Health and a third one. I forget who it was. It's overly regulated, period, end of the story. If we're going to consider this an accepted product, we need to treat it just like grapes that are grown for wine or wheat that is used to make whiskey. It is no different.
One of the things Proposition 64, originally when it first came out, it had no limit on the size of a crop that a farmer could grow. But then to appease the small growers, they threw in this thing there for the first 5 years until 2023 that no large-scale grows would be permitted. Come 2023, supposedly, that provision is going to go by the wayside.
It's going to go by the wayside. At least they promised.
What?
At least the state has promised that.
Yeah, I have a sneaky hunch that there's going to be a consortium of cops who don't want marijuana distributed anyway, small growers who don't want the competition from farmers growing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of acres, and government. Because if the price of cannabis drops dramatically to the price of grapes or anything else, since the taxation is basically based on sale price, the amount of money the government's going to make is going to be tremendously less. And so
yes,
you've got
this
triumphant, and I think they're going to pressure the state legislature not to allow that to go into effect.
I feel the same way. This is the problem of an artificial market that is created. The state is going to want to keep the price of cannabis up. It's going to make their bank swell. And this problem, this is why I want to alert your listeners, this is only going to get worse. I can't even imagine what this market will look like in 5 or 10 years if this keeps going on. Some of the things that I could predict that will – I mean, first of all, you know, I think we can all agree that all the existing problems that we know about in the cannabis industry – can be traced to this uber local control system that Yuma created, this over regulation and over taxations. The problems are evident. There's the reduction in the fair tax base is a direct result of the lower number of licensed institutions, exclusively the result of local authority to ban resulting or the bans that have resulted from that authority. And a concentration of licenses or licensed businesses in all the familiar places rather than spreading them throughout the state in order to increase the tax base and reduce the burden on the limited geographical regions, meaning the state obviously can look at Los Angeles and the Bay Area and say, well, they're the ones that got to come up with it all. This system has made it so that only individuals or conglomerates with $2 to $3 million to invest can accomplish obtaining one of the limited number of licenses available. The lack of statewide competition is also one of the main causes of the continued increased price to consumers that you pointed out. That would be one way of combating that problem you pointed out, Lanny, is reducing the regulations, providing more licensing, allowing more competition.
You know, I remember when 64 was being pushed in 2016, one of our big arguments is that 64 will do away with the criminal market. You know, the criminal market growing on national forest lands, people growing illegally and all this. By legalizing it, we're going to do away with the criminal market. But 64 is so convoluted and made it so expensive that the legal growers who get licensed and all this kind of stuff can't begin to compete in prices with the illegal market.
It's impossible. It's almost like what they created was they took the old prohibition world, carved it out, left it standing, and then created another license world. And you just can't eliminate the other under this system they have. It just seems like a virtual impossibility unless the entire state opens up. Which is one of the things that I advocate, that it really replicate the alcohol licensing system, where the state determines where the need is, and they determine the number of licenses that are issued in a local area, and the local municipality's only role is determining where it goes, and that is it.
Well, you know,
that is a much
fairer
system.
The local municipalities really are one of the reasons this was put into to AMA, this thing about municipalities being able to ban and all this kind of stuff, was one, because they felt that the Supreme Court already said they had that right to do so, although it seemed to me if the proposition had put in that they didn't have the right to do so, then they couldn't do it. So the municipalities continue this banning thing, which makes it just impossible for
it's impossible. Every single problem the cannabis commercial industry is experiencing can be traced to these bans. Literally every single one. And it's such a problem. We need to be aware of it. We need to start talking about it and see what we can do to get it changed.
And one of the things on top of what you're talking about, these bans and all this kind of stuff, and the regulations becoming so stringent that you have to have millions of dollars just to open up, one of the things ALMA was supposed to do was supposed to have social equity, where people who had been busted before and this kind of stuff, and minority groups and this kind of stuff, would be able to have entrance into this industry. But like you said, it costs so much money to get into it that it makes it impossible for mom and pop operations to operate.
It does. And some benefit has come from that. I mean, you get big conglomerates coming in from Seattle and Oregon, and they have to find a social equity partner who all of a sudden, is getting some income from the business because they're required to have that social equity partner. But again, this needs to happen all throughout the state, not just in Oakland and Los Angeles. It just makes no sense. And so they're not even meeting that goal because in the end, there's, again, not enough license, too expensive to get them, causing minorities to be locked out and forced to team up with other people, business partners, that can foot the bill. And so,
okay, very good. So what would you suggest? One, two, three, four. What specific things need to be done to Proposition 64 to rectify the situation and make 64 really do what it was meant to do, which was not just to end cannabis prohibition, but to make the product available locally, reliably, legally, and affordably?
Well, you know, we could start from the bottom, I guess, from the bottom meaning the last. We started with the criminal justice issue, and we ended up with the commercial regulation, taxation world of it. So we could start right there. Certainly, the legislature or a new proposition needs to create a system where the number of licenses available are determined by the state, and the burden is placed on local municipalities to place before their local voters a total ban. That would be a much more fair system. It would create more licensed businesses. It would create a larger tax base, spread it throughout the state, create competition, lower the price of cannabis production, lower the taxes as well is another thing that they have to address in that aspect of it. They cannot continue to allow local municipalities to tax at the height that they do. It basically creates a system where in every single business, the local government is a partner of every single dispensary, retail outfit, grow operation, whatever it may be. And lastly, in addition to that, is they need to, or not lastly, secondly, they need to reduce the amount of regulations by at least 50% in order to not make it so burdensome on the cultivators and thereby reducing the cost of cannabis in this system that we're all trying to make fair for everybody. And lastly, they really need to address these very serious aspects of the criminal justice problems that Yuma left open. They need to eliminate the use of conspiracy and except to a very narrow, limited number of very serious cannabis offenses. They need to eliminate the use of Health and Safety Code Section 11366 and 11366.5, which is, you know, maintaining a place for purposes of storage. That was the law that we spoke about. And these three areas, taxation, regulation, local control, and criminal justice, if they are addressed, we're going to have a much more fairer system than we currently have. At this rate, I can only fathom what the future will look like, but it's not going to look good. And so let's see what we can all do to address these issues. And I encourage your listeners to make their representatives aware of these problems.
Do you know of, is there any organization that is working to rectify these problems?
The last I had heard, and this is only information that I never verified, so I suppose I would have to verify it, that there was a proposed proposition that was going to try to, they were going to try to put it on the ballot in 2020. They didn't have enough funding, and it was going to address many of these issues. I almost, you know, I think that if it was going to be done by proposition, it would have to be a very limited one. Limited in the sense of not as verbose, not have so much wordage as 64 did, and just narrowly address these issues. But simultaneously, I think that if the problem is brought to light, that the legislature may find time to address some of them right away and leave others for another day. But the problems are going to continue to persist. And if we were trying to get rid of – I was just going to say, if we were trying to get rid of felony offenses, Yuma just didn't do it. It really didn't. If we were trying to get rid of asset forfeiture, it didn't get rid of it. If we were trying to create a fair market where people can, you know, go purchase just about anywhere and have fair prices and not overly taxed, it hasn't accomplished that. It's a total failure.
Well, you know, the state legislatures, I think there's probably sympathetic people in the state legislature. I mean, the tax money, which you're talking about, is really important. I mean, in the last quarter, the state took in $307 million in taxes. That's the most since 2018 when the taxes first started being collected. It's an 80% increase over the same quarter last year. So the taxes are coming in. So they're going to have to be guarded. But It would seem to me that if that they could take in more taxes by streamlining the market, making it more easily available, ending these bans, and basically putting the illegal market out of business. Because,
yes.
I mean, as I understand, the illegal market is the majority of cannabis.
It's majority, and it's so easy to put it out of business. Just give out more licenses. That's it.
Yeah,
I mean,
and you know, and it's for local governments. They can make a lot of money. Here in Riverside County, Desert Hot Springs, which is kind of a hotbed of cannabis activity, they're even going to have cannabis hotels and entertainment venues pretty soon. But they took in $4.2 million in the 2019-20 fiscal year. $4.2 million. Their entire budget for the entire city is only $14 million. So suddenly they're getting this huge infusion.
20%
of
their budget is coming from cannabis. Yeah.
Well, this is money above and beyond. I mean, they still get that $14 million. Suddenly they're getting $4 to $5 million more dollars they've never had before. And Desert Hot Springs is what I sometimes refer to as the armpit of the Coachella Valley. It's a very poor, economically depressed area, and this money is hopefully going to turn this town around. And I think one of the reasons we've had, you know, 33 other municipalities approve cannabis businesses in the November elections is because they're all looking for money because COVID-19 has so impacted them financially. They're looking for new sources of revenue. But it's got to be done realistically and reasonably. They can't impose these taxes on this system that you talked about that is so jury-rigged, so unfair, that it's just impossible. You're right. It needs to be changed.
It does, and I definitely propose that. And you know, our goal was what? To make the cannabis world more fair and just. That was Prop 64's goal. We haven't gotten there, and we need to keep going.
Right, and so, you know, I think you've given us a really good outline of the problems, and you've also enumerated kind of what we have to do to correct those problems. And now we just got to develop the will and the ability to make this happen. And I don't know if any organization is willing to take that on. Cal Normal would be the perfect one, I guess, but
the
I don't
leading,
know how much
the
they're
leading.
Yeah. How much? I mean, I would certainly support this with my organization here in the Inland Empire. We would do what he can with our state legislators here, and we do work with them to a certain degree. We can meet with them and listen to them, but this thing has to be kind of done statewide if it's ever going to happen.
There's got to be a statewide groundswell for this,
and
that's why I'm trying to bring these problems to light and hope to create that. And so.
Well,
you know,
I'd be happy to
come back on the show any other time and continue.
Well, we'll
to
do that
so.
Again. You certainly, you know, started the conversation here, and I hope to something will come out of it. And maybe get you back on here in another 3 or 4 months. When this COVID-19 thing begins to wind down with the state now in a total lockdown, and everything, state legislators are not going to pay any attention to reforming cannabis laws.
No, right, nobody's going to do anything right now.
But halfway into 2021, maybe that'll be the time to start looking at reforming these laws to make it more just, to make it more fair, to make it more reasonable. So people, and you know, I've always believed that cannabis, access to cannabis, is very important for the health of the community. And the major reason, as an RN, I believe that cannabis is the only viable alternative to alcohol as a celebrant and something for celebration and socialization, this kind of stuff. And alcohol is a horrid, horrid product, responsible, as the Center for Disease Control says, $250 billion. That's what the harm, the Center for Disease Control thinks. Alcohol is $250 billion. If cannabis, we well know there's all kinds of studies show that cannabis is easily, widely, and affordably available. Alcohol consumption goes down significantly. And
yes,
that
it increases creativity, and alcohol increases violence. And
that's
all
right.
Sorts of other.
Nobody comes home, smokes a joint, and beats up their wife. So They may, like I say, they come home, they're tired from work, they drink a six-pack of beer, they beat up the old lady, they come home tired from work, they smoke a joint, they make love to the old lady. That's the difference between cannabis and alcohol. And we've got to do what we have to do to make it more available. It's for the good of our society. And what you have put forth today is a pathway to making that happen. And I want to thank you for taking the time to join us on the show and bring this to everyone's attention.
Thank you. It was great being on your show, Lanny.
Okay. Thanks, David, and we will be in touch again. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Well,
bye-bye.
That's it for tonight's show. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any questions, you know, David, are you still there? No, he's not. You know, I should have asked him to give you out information if you wanted to contact him. But I guess what I could say, if you wanted, you could send him an email. And David's address, email address is, let me see if I can find it here. My gosh, what is David's email address? I don't have it. Ah! Let me see. Give me half a second. Let me see if I can bring it up real quick here. Let me see here. I am so sorry. I should have been prepared, but I'm sure you would love to hear from you. So let me see if I can find it here. Just be patient. I'm looking it up here. I should have been more prepared for doing that, and I wasn't. But let's see what I can bring up here. Let's see. Okay. J. David Nick. Oh, it's not there. Oh, my gosh. Let me check in another place here. Are you patient? You are so patient. Thank you for being patient with me on the show here. And I'm sorry. I'm looking this up here for you. I hope you found it as interesting as I can. You know, when 64 was on the ballot, you know, we had a lot of very impassioned arguments about it, and we really were hoping that it's going to make things different, and it did. I mean, to sit there and say, let's go back to when we didn't have 64 would be absurd. Nobody wants to do that. But it does need corrections. And if you want to get hold of J. David, here is his email address. And his email address is, get ready, it is jdavidnick@lawyer.com. I should have done that right in that in my head. jdavidnick@lawyer.com. You can send him an email, and I'm sure he would reply to you. So anyway, thank you very much for joining us on today's show. Please let your friends know about it, and we're going to let go out of the show once again with a song by called "Lead the Way" by. This is just everything's going out of my head today. I can't believe it. Here's the song, Lead the Way. Thank you for joining us. Pay attention. We'll be on again at another time. Bye-bye.
Capture all the
by the way, is Lynette Shaw. I apologize for not knowing that. Here's the rest of the song.